Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Everyone, I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters podcast. We had said last week that Jonathan Pennington would be our guest. Unfortunately, he had cancer, and it looks like he's going to be back, I think, August 31st. But I had someone who was willing to step in and fill in the shoes, and I'm really excited about this guest. We have the one who I'd call the Chuck Norris of Christian apologetics here, and that is our guest, Dr. Timothy McGrew. Tim, are you here?
I'm right here, Nick.
Okay. Well, I've often said before, unfortunately, most people are in apologetics might not know who you are too much. So tell us a bit about who you are and why my audience should be listening to what you have to say today.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is I'm not Chuck Norris. But I take it this is your way of asking me for a little bias. So I'm a professor of philosophy at Western Michigan University, where I have been teaching now for 18 years in the undergraduate and graduate programs. And I specialize in epistemology, especially formal epistemology, probability, and philosophy of science, and the history of science. But I have a special interest in Christian apologetics, and in particular in the Gospels and Acts in the New Testament generally. And that's probably more than anything I've done in the history and philosophy of science or epistemology, the reason that you've got me on today.
Okay, and for those who are interested in calling in and asking Tim a question, the number is 714-242-5180. Of course, the real question everyone's wanting to ask is, did Han Solo shoot first?
Of course he shot first! Yeah, I'm glad Pete, you went right to the serious stuff first.
Yep. Oh, yeah, Tim's Star Wars fan. I found that out. That was a bit of a surprise to me. But, okay, now let's get to the other stuff. You start talking about the Gospels. One topic that is pretty interesting is that usually when you meet some atheists or non, they'll say, look, no one knows who wrote the Gospels. They're just a bunch of anonymous documents and such, and we don't need to have any reason to take why Matthew wrote Matthew seriously or anything like that, but it's just a big free-for-all. You seem to have a problem
right
with that.
Yeah, I do have a problem with that. I mean, you know, usually the first thing I do when somebody says that is, so tell me what evidence you think we have or don't have regarding the authorship, and tell me what kind of evidence you think we should have. You know, the funny thing is, this whole argument is just about 16 centuries old. It goes back to about the year 400, which is the first time that we've got anybody actually going on record by name questioning the traditional authorship of the Gospels. That's a long time after they were written, but Faustus the Manichaean said, well, how do we really know? Maybe they're wrong about who these... And he was roundly trounced by St. Augustine. And Augustine's question was really very simple. He said, why does no one doubt the genuineness of books attributed to the Greek physician Hippocrates? Well, nobody doubts it because there's a succession of testimonies to the books from the time of Hippocrates to the present day, and that makes it unreasonable either now or hereafter to have any doubt on the subject. This is how we know about the authorship of the works of Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, Varro, and other similar writers. It's an unbroken chain of evidence. And that's what we have with respect to the Gospels. I think people sometimes are a little bit shocked to learn that we actually have quite excellent evidence. And we, if you try to demand more, I think it's only fair to do turnabout and to say, if you're going to demand more there, why not demand it elsewhere? And what that will do is it'll cut just a wide swath through all of classical history. If you apply the same standards everywhere, you should come out saying, well, yeah, we have great reason to think that Matthew and Mark and Luke and John are the authors of those four Gospels in our New Testament.
What are those great reasons?
Well, I think that there are four different kinds of evidence that I think they're all worth taking seriously. There's the evidence just of the names that they bear. Try to think of it from the standpoint of cooking up an alternative hypothesis. Either these guys were known to have written these works, or they weren't. And if they weren't, somebody had to make up and attribute those names to them. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're making up a name to attribute to a work that you want to be received in the Christian community as gospel truth, as being authoritative, then the most natural thing in the world is to look for an authoritative name.
Mm-hmm.
So who do they pick? They pick Matthew. What do we know about Matthew? Besides the fact that there's a gospel that has been called the gospel according to Matthew, well, we know that he was a tax collector, which was a very looked down upon profession, a very frowned upon profession, that would immediately discredit him in the eyes of a readership who wanted authoritative evidence. Mark, the only thing that we know about Mark, really, from the book of Acts, is that his unwillingness to be bold enough split up the missionary duo of Paul and Barnabas. That's hardly a commendation. Luke, we get scarcely mentioned except just a few mentions through the Pauline letters. You know, Luke, the beloved physician, or only Luke is with me. Very little about Luke. The only name that really stands out among the names on our four Gospels is the name of John. The other three, only one of them even supposed to be a disciple, and really not the kind of person you would go to. Now, in the second century, when all of the living witnesses were dead, you get the Gospel of Peter. That would make great sense if you were forging it. Pick Peter. He's a pillar of the church, major figure. But these other names, with the exception of John, just don't make sense as an attempt to give credibility by ascribing the work to someone, falsely ascribing the work to someone of great prestige. So that's the first reason. It's just the names that they bear themselves really don't support the hypothesis that these were chosen by someone who didn't know who had written them. There's a second argument in the form of the title. Most classical works are entitled with the author's name in the possessive and then a title of the work, like Aristotle's Poetics or Plato's Republic. So you get the name in a possessive form, maybe a genitive form, and then you have the name of the book, so the author's name first. None of our Gospels is named that way. They're all referred to with striking uniformity as the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, the Gospel according to Luke. As Martin Hengel, the renowned biblical scholar, notes, this is a very unusual form of title, and the uniformity suggests that there was not doubt, and so you don't have a bunch of different people trying to make up different titles. That's another thing. There's absolutely no tradition of authorship except the tradition that we have. There is no other tradition of authorship for any of these works. Nowhere in the church was there ever any doubt or even question about these works. And they were known, and they were circulated. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Could we say, though, that there is some speculation in terms of the Gospel of John, whether it's John the Elder or John an Apostle, but it's still agreed some guy named John wrote it.
Right. So until you get to Eusebius, you don't have any doubt about the identity of John, and when you get to Eusebius, the doubt is cast on the authorship of the book of Revelation, because Eusebius doesn't like the eschatology that he finds there. Mm-hmm. So Eusebius is looking for a reason not to attribute that to an apostle. Okay, you know, Eusebius is writing in the early 4th century, and he's a diligent raker together of a lot of good information. So I don't want to just slam Eusebius, but it's a long time before there's actually any serious doubt about that. I am persuaded, and we could get into this some other time, that John the Presbyter was John the Apostle, that there is not some separate character, John the Presbyter, who is separate from John the Apostle. That's an interpretive argument, and that takes some, you know, hard staring at some words quoted from Papias, but that would be where I would come down on that one. So until Eusebius, you don't really find an attempt to separate them, and even then, Eusebius originally didn't do that in the Chronicon. It's only in his history that he tries to separate the two.
Okay, so let's go back to where you were.
I think I was just thinking on the third one. Yeah, I was listing a bunch of reasons. Another reason that I think, besides the titles, that they're just whose names they bear, besides the forms of the titles, the widespread use. These Gospels, especially Matthew, was used very, very early, and we have reasonable support for the early use of all four Gospels. And this is here's a point that I think is important to make in this connection. When you contrast that with the extremely sparse evidence for the use in the church of the Gnostic so-called Gospels, you find there's really no comparison. There's very strong, very early evidence of the use of our four canonical Gospels and very sparse indications of the use of any of the others. A few people read the Gospel of Peter. There were some people who took Tatian's Diatessaron, and that would be around the middle of the 2nd century, around the 150s, 160s. But the Diatessaron is just a harmony of the four Gospels that are in our canon and was put together pretty obviously, deliberately, just to try to harmonize them all into one narrative. I don't think he did a very good job, but that's beside the point. He was working with our four.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tim, we also have to look at the counter-evidence, and I think one of your favorite arguments that's obviously so killer to the idea is that Matthew talks about himself in the third person in his Gospels. I mean, that's just
the
case right there.
Yeah, and you know, here's the truly sad thing about this is that Bart Ehrman makes this argument, and it was also made by Faustus in that same in exchange with Augustine, and Augustine absolutely slams it. So here's the way the argument works. Matthew chapter 9, verse 9, we read that as Jesus was passing by, he saw this guy sitting at the receipt of custom, and he said, "You come and follow me," and he rose and followed him. So it's all in the third person, narrated in the third person. Well, so runs the argument. Who uses the third person to talk about himself? And the answer is all kinds of people. In fact, that's pretty much the rule in Greek historical work of the time and even earlier. Even in Latin works, Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars, he refers to himself throughout the commentaries in the third person. There's only one place where he ever says I, and he's very careful in that one place not to give you a clue as to who he is. He's not doing this because he's trying to be sneaky. He's doing this because he's following the historical style that you get in a work like Xenophon's Anabasis. Xenophon's a Greek historian, and he writes about his own personal experiences, but as he writes about them, the very first time that he makes an entrance, it's in the third person. There was a man, a friend of Proxenes, named Xenophon. He wasn't himself a soldier, but et cetera. It Josephus in the Jewish Wars, most of the time, refers to himself in the third person. He's a participant. And the norm seems to be that if you're a participant, then you refer to yourself in that fashion. That was the style in those days. So to say, well, that's evidence against Matthew's having written the first gospel in our New Testament canon is absolutely ridiculous. It flies in the face of what we know about the norms of historical writing in the time. So I think that's shameful that that argument is even out there. So you've successfully pushed my buttons there. You got me to rant a little bit about that argument.
Well, another aspect of that I was thinking is that Ehrman, as well as many New Testament scholars, would say 2 Corinthians is a genuine Pauline epistle. And yet when we get to 2 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about the story. He says, I knew a man who 14 years ago in Christ, and as far as I know, it's pretty much unanimously agreed, Paul's talking about himself. But
absolutely.
He doesn't say,
right.
I.
Right, but that's just understood to be one of the common tropes, as it were, one of the rhetorical methods of speaking of oneself. Now, it's not absolutely 100% of the time done. You can find Josephus using the first person sometimes, but it's very common. And so here we have one reference to Matthew as an actor, and it refers to him as he. Well, for crying out loud, you know, that we've got whole books that are done entirely that way, and we've got books where that's done over and over and over and over and over. Why shouldn't that be the case here? In a Greek writing in the same century in which Josephus is writing, but shouldn't that tell us something? Of course it should.
In fact, I understand that the writings of Plutarch, they never name who wrote them in their writings, and the reason we believe Plutarch wrote them is because one of his grandsons, about 100 years later, says, yes, Plutarch wrote those. And that's not questioned today.
Right. Exactly. And that's an example of the double standard that just bugs me no end. That's the double standard of saying, let's have, certain kinds of evidence be completely satisfactory in classics, in history, but when it comes to the New Testament, suddenly we become hyper-skeptics. Suddenly, there's just absolutely nothing that could be good enough, you know, or at least not as long as we've got it, you know. Very, very skeptical. And I think that this has led to absurdity, and that this example of Matthew's use of the third person is just one example of that absurdity.
I think one of your other favorite examples of this is that if something happens in the Bible, we need evidence outside of the Bible that it took place, or else we have to call into question what the Bible says.
Well, for crying out loud, let's do that in Roman history. There are plenty of events for which Suetonius is our only Roman historian as a source. And he's hardly the most respected of the Roman historians, especially after the Augustus. He seems to really drop off in quality, and a lot of historians don't, you know, feel like he does a very good job. He's writing more kind of just as a public intellectual than as a true historian, etc. And yet, for many of those events, nobody has any doubt that those took place. There are events that only Josephus narrates, events in the life of Herod the Great that we have only from Josephus, no other author. And some of them are fairly striking, and you might even say prima facie implausible, and yet nobody takes, you know, blinks at that. Nobody says, well, Josephus, you know, I that has no credibility unless we have another source. Would we like another independent source? Sure. Would that be useful? Absolutely. But you can't be picky like that in history. The question is always, what's the most reasonable thing to do with the evidence we do have? And it's no sense complaining about the evidence you don't.
In fact, we could even, one of my favorite examples to use is the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD that destroyed Pompeii, and we only have one reference to that, and that's an offhand reference from Pliny about it. He's not even really talking about it, he just says it offhand.
Actually, I don't even think he mentions the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum. The destruction of those two towns is mentioned only over a century later in Diocasius, and when it's mentioned, it's all festooned with a bunch of, remarkable additions, like the clouds lowered up in the shape of, you know, monsters over the towns and things like this. And yet we've got earlier references to the eruption, we've got a letter from Pliny. We've got a letter from, I think it's mentioned also in Suetonius, but that's it. They don't mention that it destroyed these two towns, one of them very wealthy, the other rather highly populated. You'd think the governor of Bithynia would have said, oh, yeah, by the way, there was, you know, destruction of these towns, and it's remarkable that people got out in time and all that, because he talks about his uncle trying to go in and rescue people and dying in the attempt. But it's only 100 years later we hear about that. Nobody doubts it, though, because we've dug them up, right? And yet, if we were to apply the skepticism that it gets applied to the New Testament, we'd have to say, well, we have only one source, and that source is late, and that source, it has got elements that look like they could be legendary. Well, I mean, we have earlier sources that don't mention it. Surely they would have mentioned it. No, they just didn't. That's a good example of the argument from silence. And arguments from silence get a terrible amount of play in New Testament studies that they just don't deserve.
Okay, well, we're here with Tim McGrew. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, we're going to go to the next step in our program here about the Gospels. And it looks like we have a caller, and we'll get to you when we get back. I'm Nick Peters. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're back with Tim McGrew. Our caller number is 714-242-5180, and it looks like we have a caller. Do you want to take a call here, Tim?
Absolutely. Why not?
Okay. And caller, you are on the air with Tim McGrew.
Hi. Yeah, this is Bethany Rohde. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Bethany.
Hi.
Great to hear from you.
Yes, good to hear from you, too. I just had a quick question about in 1 Corinthians 15, when we hear about, just a second, Clary, I'm on the phone. when we hear about, you know, Christ appearing to the 500 eyewitnesses, and I always find that so completely fascinating because, yes, you know, it's indicated that many or some of them are alive, and you could go back and check with them, you know, and sort of verify what we're talking about here. Just a second, sweetheart.
He wants to get into the conversation, too.
She does. She does. Anyway, I was just curious, is there ever any other mention of that, like, in any kind of other document or anything? Because it's just fascinating to me to think, you know, there's these 500 people out there somewhere, and they had to talk to someone at some time, and doesn't mean it ever got written down or preserved, but I was just curious, is there any thoughts on that?
Well, the most common position is that that's probably a reference to the appearance of Jesus in Galilee in Matthew 28, toward the end of Matthew 28, verses 16 and 17.
Okay.
And Matthew doesn't specify how many people, but we do know that the word disciples was used for more than just the original circle of 12. Jesus had the 70 disciples, and he had many other followers. And so it is most likely that that was it, but we don't know for sure. Here's the thing about that, though. Paul is writing to a church in 1 Corinthians. He's writing to a Corinthian church where he has enemies. He's got adversaries who are working to undermine his authority. And this is something that you see coming out very clearly in 1 Corinthians. So the worst thing in the world that he could do would be to make a bold statement that could just be shown to be false. Right? He's writing somewhere where there are people who've got the means and the motive and the opportunity of exposing him if he makes a claim that is not a notorious truth. Now, he's not trying to persuade anyone in that context that Jesus rose from the dead. Some readers read 1 Corinthians 15, they think, oh, is this the earliest Christian argument for the resurrection of Jesus? No, what Paul's doing, he cites that early creed, but only for the purpose of reminding them what they've already learned in the process of becoming Christians. He says, I delivered to you that which I also received. Those words are a rabbinic formula that would be used by a rabbi to his pupil, saying, I'm giving to you just what was taught to me by my rabbi. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons, there are several others, that that's thought to be a very early creed. Now, it may be that the creed goes through 500 at once, and then Paul interjects parenthetically, of whom the greater part are still alive. But he expects his readers actually to accept that as a notorious fact. Most of those witnesses, doubtless, would be back either in Jerusalem or northward in Galilee, since it got kind of hot for Christians down in the Jerusalem area. But there was a tremendous amount of travel in ancient times, and so it's extremely likely that people went back and forth. And so you could, if you really cared about it and you wanted to check up on it, you could find somebody who had been a witness. You could get in touch. Even, you know, when Paul comes into Damascus, just having been converted on the road, you know, they're a little bit leery about him, but they're there. He was confident he could find the Christians there, even though he wasn't a Christian. If you went to someone sincerely asking, seeking, you could find them.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Bethany?
Thanks for the call, Bethany.
Yeah.
Bethany, if I could point in a couple other things. Also, we do have some resources here. Back in the week of Easter, during that week before Easter, I interviewed Gary Happermas on here, and we talked about the 1 Corinthians 15 creed. And on June 29th, I had Mike Lacona come on, and part of it was talking about minimal facts found in that creed, and both of them have excellent books on this topic.
Yes, this is the all-star team. All right. Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bethany.
All right, bye-bye.
And, you know, we should point out, Bethany, I believe, is part of the Christian Apologetics Alliance, and you're a pretty prominent member of the Christian Apologetics Alliance also. Maybe some of my listeners would like to know what that is.
Christian Apologetics Alliance is a group of Christians who are very passionately interested in apologetics, and they're committed to, you know, basic orthodoxy with respect to the deity of Christ and the the reliability of Scripture. And so it's a group that is organized on Facebook and on Google Plus. We've got thousands of members from all around the world. We've got people who are active participants from New Zealand. We've got people from the Czech Republic. We've got people just from every corner, South Africa. Very interesting, very vibrant group. We don't always agree on everything, shocker, but that's okay. But these are people who see apologetics as vitally important, and they're willing to put in some time, and they're also willing to help others in that. A lot of these people are involved in local ministries. So if you're interested, look up Christian Apologetics Alliance on Facebook or on Google Plus, and we've got our statement of faith and a little sort of rules of behavior that we ask you to agree to, and we'd love to have people join in if they're interested. If they're Christians, this is a Christian group. If you're not a Christian, you're interested in these things, we'd love to put you in touch with some people who would love to talk with you, and that's fine. And they're not going to come like the Mormons to your door. But if you got questions, we'd like to hear them, and we'd like to talk about them. But this is a group for Christians who are really passionate about apologetics.
And in case the listeners haven't caught on, I'm also a member of the CAA. Been there for a while, and always post whenever I'm going to do a show here. So a lot of the members of the CAA are listening, because we are thankful world of Tim McGrew.
Well, you're very kind.
Well, now let's get back to the case. So now we're going to go from here and act as if the authorship of a gospel has been established. I know we could say a whole lot more about that, but one other aspect you'd like to talk about is how gospels and Acts tie into the non-Christian history of a time. Can you expound on that?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, one of the things that we look for when we're reading a historical document is the question, how well does this document integrate with the other things that we know about the history of that time? If we know, for example, things about other characters, we wonder whether they'll crop up. Now, if the stories are local and those other characters are far away and doing great deeds in other parts of the world, maybe they won't come up, but maybe they will. And one of the really interesting things about the Gospels is just how tightly they are nailed into the history of the early first century. It's not just that they name prominent figures, or that they always give those prominent figures their proper titles, or their proper roles, or that the actions of those figures are in character with what we know about it, although those are all true. It's also incidental things. The situation in Palestine between the year 6 BC and the year AD 44, so a period of 50 years, this is a really complicated period with a lot of changes. It starts out, Herod the Great is the ruler of a united kingdom. He's a native ruler of the area. He's not a Jew, he's a Dumian, but he is a native ruler. So the Romans have allowed a native ruler to be one of their client kings, and he's got the rulership over the whole thing. Then he dies, and that kingdom is divided up into a set of principalities under native ethnarchs and tetrarchs, each of whom holds a little bit of it. Then one of those people, Archelaus, badly mismanages his portion, which is Judea, and that portion is just reduced to the level of a Roman province. Archelaus is banished, and a Roman governors come in the fullness of time. That's where we get Pontius Pilate. Pilate is just one in a series of governors who came in to rule that area as a governor, but notice they're outsiders, and it's reduced to a provincial level. It's not a kingdom. It's not an ethnarchy. But then the whole thing, to the full extent of Herod the Great's initial kingdom, is reunited under a native ruler, and that's Agrippa the First. And then finally, it's reduced wholly under Rome and governed by procurators. They're dependent on the president of Syria. But there's still Agrippa the first son, Agrippa the second, who has a certain amount of authority over religious matters in Jerusalem. All of that happens in the span of 50 years. That you can't find 50 years of English history that complicated with that many twists and changes. And it confuses the daylights out of Roman historians. Even Tacitus, who is probably our most careful Roman historian covering the period, seems to have gotten confused at one point. And frankly, Dio Cassius can't keep one Herod straight from another. Because there's Herod the Great, there's Herod Antipas, there's Herod Agrippa the First, there's Herod Agrippa the Second. All these Herods who are typically just called Herod in the Bible. And yet in every case, the authors of the Gospels and Acts get it right. They nail that down. They never make a slip in what's a province at one time, what's a what's under senatorial control, what's under imperial control, what's left alone as a client kingdom. They always get that right. They even get it right to the point where in the book of Acts, in chapter 12, we read a reference right at the beginning of the chapter about Herod the king. About that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hand to trouble the church. Well, now here's the funny thing. There hadn't been a king there for the past 40 years. And there would never be a king thereafter. Ever. Except in the last 3 years of the reign of Agrippa the First.
Mm-hmm.
There and there only. And that's exactly the right time for what we're reading about right there in Luke. So he nails it with something, it's an aside. It's just a reference, Herod the king. But there was no Herod the king before, and there would never be a Herod the king after. Just that one little three-year window in there. That okay. is the kind of precision that I'm talking about.
Okay, what are some other examples, like in the Gospels? What else did we find?
Okay, well, let's start in Matthew chapter 2. Everybody remembers the story of the slaughter of the innocents. Which is completely in keeping with Herod the Great, despite the fact that we don't have any other contemporaneous source detailing it.
Reason for us to not believe it, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Anytime it's not multiply attested. You know, multiple attestation is like icing on a cake. It's great, but you can eat the cake without it. Multiple attestation is a good thing when we have it. It doesn't mean that when we don't, the thing is suspect, right? Save suspicion for cases where you actually have grounds for suspicion or where you have no evidence, positive evidence at all. Anyway, But the thing I'm talking about is just a curious little detail in the way that Matthew tells this story. After Herod the Great dies, Joseph and Mary and Jesus start on the road back from Egypt, perhaps Alexandria. They start on their way back over eastward and then northward into Judea. They're heading back up toward Jerusalem. But then you get to Matthew 2:22, which says that when Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in his father's place in Judea, he was troubled. So here's a puzzle. Archelaus was the oldest surviving son of Herod the Great. He had no real reputation up to that point that we know of. And it was pretty typical when a client king had been keeping the tax monies flowing for Rome to rubber stamp his choice of his heir. So there was really nothing particularly surprising about Herod the Great giving Judea to his eldest surviving son. So why does it strike Joseph as news, and news that suddenly makes him change his mind? You can read all the way through the New Testament. We have no other mention of Archelaus. There's no other reference to him. We don't know why Joseph would be freaked out until we turn to Josephus, the Jewish historian, who gives us his own account of doings at that time. It turns out Archelaus had come into power, stepped into power, just before Passover. His father had died just weeks before Passover. He stepped into the power vacuum, following his father's will, but without waiting to get Rome's direct permission. And one of the last things Herod the Great had done was to have a couple of Jews executed for sedition. That was a very unpopular move by Herod the Great. The Jews were extremely unhappy about it, but Herod the Great was dead. So here at Passover time, you've got hundreds of thousands of Jews flocking to Jerusalem. The story spread like wildfire. They got upset and they rioted. A big group of Jews got into an argument with a small group of Roman soldiers. They stoned the soldiers. Most of the soldiers died. And Archelaus hit the panic button. He sent out a troop of horsemen. The perpetrators fled into the temple, right? I'm on base. You can't touch me. So Archelaus sent out a troop of horsemen to surround the temple. He said, don't let anybody inside get out. Don't let anybody outside go in. And then he sent troops directly into the temple, and he slaughtered 3,000 Jews inside the temple. Passover was canceled. He told the Jews, go home. Now, put yourself back on the road heading up towards Jerusalem from the direction of Egypt, from the south. Here's Joseph with Mary and the infant child, and here come all these Passover pilgrims fleeing Jerusalem. And what do they say? Archelaus is reigning in Jerusalem. Is that where they stop? No, they tell the whole story, of course. And so Joseph says to himself, now let me remember, why did I leave for Egypt in a hurry at night? I was fleeing a homicidal maniac. Guess what? I'm heading back up to Jerusalem, and there's a homicidal maniac. I got some property up north in Nazareth. I think we'll go there. So the whole story makes beautiful sense when you view it in connection with the background that you get from Josephus. If you don't view it with that background, you don't understand what's going on. And so this is one of those verses I think Christians read past without really understanding a lot of times, because we don't often read Josephus.
You know, this has reminded me of a blog post I wrote that you really liked. It's about how we need to read other books besides the Bible, because
absolutely,
if all we have is just the Bible...
The Bible is not simply a self-contained, perfectly clear, self-interpreting text. It's a wonderful, vital, important, inspired text, but it requires us to understand it in the context of its time. And when we do, the whole thing comes alive, and you see it in sort of a 3D. That, I think, is one of the most exciting things. And I got more examples if you want to go into them, but I don't want to railroad it if you want to go somewhere else.
We're getting ready to take another break, but I think there's another way that we can talk about the authenticity of the Gospels as well, and we'll do that when we get back.
All right.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Well, I sure hope it doesn't, especially not here at the Deeper Waters podcast. Number is 714-242-5180. My guest is Dr. Timothy McGrew. In this segment, we're going to be talking more about the authenticity of the Gospels with one of your favorite points, I think, undesigned coincidences. Now, what is an undesigned coincidence?
Right. Let's start by saying what's a simple coincidence. In the Gospels, you might have a story about Jesus that is told in some places in very nearly the same words as it is in another gospel. That's a coincidence. But it's, of course, very questionable to try to use that as if it were an independent source. The obvious immediate reply is, look, why do you think this is independent? Maybe one of these guys just used material from the other. Luke actually says he's using sources, and in some places, he seems to be following Mark. Why not just say, you know, that the Gospels are using sources and some of those sources are other Gospels? But that's like seeing two things that are the same. What if you see two passages that interlock with one another in such a way that there's no reasonable way we could say one of them was copied from another? And yet they... So maybe one of them answers some question that the other leaves unanswered. They interlock in the way that one of them explains the other, or maybe even each of them explains something about the other. Then it begins to look like we've got documents that are being written from real living history. And the reason that they interlock and explain one another is that they're both drawing their facts from life. And we're just lucky enough to have four Gospels, so sometimes they intersect in this indirect way. They interlock like two adjoining pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. They're not identical, but they fit together with one another in a particularly satisfying way. Fiction's not like that. Nobody reads The Lord of the Rings in order to clear up those unexplained bits of Moby Dick. That's just not the way fiction works. Mm-hmm. But in this case, real history, if you have enough of it, may sometimes give you that. And the great thing is, these kinds of undesigned coincidences, these interlockings, are scattered all through the Gospels. They crisscross them. There are dozens of these. And the really impressive thing about them is not just hearing them described, like I'm describing them now, or hearing one example here or one example there. The real effect of the argument is cumulative. When you hear an example and then another one and then another one and then another one, and you realize these are not all just, say, Mark explaining everybody else. Instead, they go every which way. You've got John explaining Mark, and you've got Mark explaining something in Matthew, and you've got Matthew explaining something in Luke, and they go every which way, crisscrossing the Gospels in all directions. That's when you realize whatever use these guys may have made of one another's material source-wise, they also all have independent sources of evidence that nevertheless interlock in this interesting kind of way.
Okay, well, we've talked a lot about them. How about giving us an example?
Yeah, let's do an example. Matthew chapter 14. First couple of verses, this is the setup for telling the story of how John the Baptist died. But the lead into the story starts by talking about Herod Antipas. Not Herod the Great, he's dead, but his younger son, Herod Antipas, who's been the ruler in Galilee all along. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch, that's Herod Antipas, heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He's been raised from the dead. That's why these miraculous powers are at work in him. In other words, he's hearing about Jesus. What's Jesus doing? Baptizing in the Jordan? What else is he famous for? Well, it seems he's famous for working miracles, and Herod kind of freaks out. But the question about this, the really interesting question is, how would Matthew know what Herod is saying to his own servants? Matthew is a former tax collector, now turned itinerant preacher, right? How's he supposed to know what Herod in the privacy of his own palace is saying to his servants? And why would Herod ask his servants anyway? Well, the beautiful explanation comes not in Mark. Mark tells the story of the death of John the Baptist, but Mark doesn't mention that Herod turned to his servants. That little bit, that little detail is not there. But if you go over to Luke chapter 8, which does not tell the story of the death of John the Baptist, you find a list of women who assisted Jesus and his disciples. Frankly, Jesus and his disciples must have seemed a little too unworldly to them, and one of the things these women apparently did was to provide food and maybe shelter for these guys. They ministered to them from their substance, it says. And one of those women, you find Luke chapter 8, verse 3, is Joanna. All right, so we have a name. But then she's described, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager. And there we go. Jesus' followers had family in the highest rank of Herod Antipas' paid servants. So right there, you've got an example of that interlocking. Neither of these can be quoted from the other. Neither of them is borrowed from the other. But Luke explains something left dangling in Matthew in a particularly satisfying way, removes our puzzlement about it. So there's one example. Shall I give a couple more?
In fact, with Alan Quinn, we also add that in the epistles and in Acts, there are people who are named after Herod as well, who could have just as well also been part of a household.
There's Manaen in Acts, who grew up with Herod the Tetrarch, and so he is a possible person as well. But I like this one because it actually says that Chuza was his household manager, which would be a servant role, and so that just dovetails beautifully with what we find in Matthew, just that passing reference to his, you know, douloi, his servants.
Okay. All right. Well, give us another one.
Okay. Well, so we did one there where something that we find in Luke explains something in Matthew. Let's let Mark explain something in Matthew. Matthew chapter 8, we got a lot of miracles listed in chapters 8 and 9, but in Matthew 8, 14 through 16, we've got the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. Here's the funny thing. It says Jesus enters Peter's house, heals Peter's mother-in-law. She rose. She began to serve him. That evening, they, apparently not just the people in the house, but the whole town, brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. So here's the question. Why, if they really truly believed that Jesus could heal the sick, why did they wait until evening to come to him? One answer I will not accept is that gossip traveled slowly. I don't buy that. I think the word went around a tiny little, you know, place. He had a few hundred houses, maybe. I think word spread around there lickety-split. I think the people knew it almost immediately. But if they did, why did they wait until evening to come? You can read backwards and forwards across Matthew. You will not find the answer to this. Now, here's a case where we do have the same story told in Mark, but in Mark, there's an extra detail, not in Matthew, and that is, on the Sabbath, Jesus goes into the synagogue and teaches, and as soon as he's done with that, this is Mark chapter 1, verse 21 and following, as soon as he's done with that, he leaves the synagogue, and he enters the house of Simon and Andrew, so that's Simon Peter, and Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and then the whole story works the same way. But there's that added detail. It's on the Sabbath.
And
what that shows us...
With a Jewish society, you weren't allowed to travel so far on the Sabbath. There was a distance you could travel, but you couldn't go that far.
Not only that, but you weren't supposed to carry things like people who were paralyzed and needed to be healed. And so I think that the point of this is they were waiting for sundown. As in that day, a devout Jew, very enamored of the extra rules of the Pharisees, would wait to do anything that might be suspected of being work. You need to understand that the Jews have a very long history of taking this very seriously. In fact, just, I believe, last year, a halakhic court in Israel, a Jewish law court, passed down a ruling about something that they had wondered whether you could do on the Sabbath. And in this case, it was a very lenient ruling because it said it is okay to do this on the Sabbath. this halakhic court ruling, which was widely followed and anticipated, was on the question of whether it is permissible for a devout Jew on the Sabbath to pick his nose. And their incredibly liberal answer was, yes, it is, even though it might seem like work, but it's okay. You know, it's very difficult for many of us who don't come out of that kind of society to say, what would be the big deal, right? You bring your four-year-old child to Jesus. Of course you just pick the kid up and go. No, actually, the Jews have long taken this with exceptional seriousness. And so there's another place where we need to be culturally aware of what it was like to be a Jew in those days. There were all kinds of regulations that were designated for the priesthood, but that was the Puritan era in Judaism, that Second Temple era. And people who took their Judaism seriously typically believed in something rather like what we would in Christian circles call the priesthood of all believers. And mm-hmm. So if there was something that was just for the priests, boy, no, that was for them. What? Only the priests, strictly, literally, according to the Torah, have to wash their hands. Oh, wait, no, we're all going to do it. And so that was, that's another discussion, but an important one, because Bart Ehrman has tried to use some references to hand washing as another reason for disregarding the Gospels, and that, again, that's just historically false, and the best modern monograph on that question explodes Ehrman's reasoning.
You know, I was just thinking about that. When I first heard that from you, I thought it was funny, but, you know, what you said, I was thinking, yeah, it sounds funny to us, but for them, it's incredibly serious business, especially since Jewish culture, they knew they'd been disciplined before about not honoring the Sabbath properly and got sent to
Absolutely.
Babylon for it. And
right.
Even over there in Israel today, they even have Sabbath elevators that they don't do as much work or do it differently so that you can use an elevator on the Sabbath.
Sure. I remember a few years ago I was at a conference out in California, and I was at a hotel, and I had been wandering around. I think I'd been scouting out local restaurants or something. I came inside, and there was a woman standing looking very flustered. And she asked me, could I open a certain door for her that so that she could go up some stairs to get up to her upper floor room. Now, the elevators were working fine, but I knew immediately, because I taught at a yeshiva for a while when I was earning my way through college, I knew immediately what was going on. It's a Saturday. She's a devout Jew. And so mm-hmm. I went and I found an outside door that I could open that would lead to a stairway that she somehow couldn't get to from where she was, and then she was able to go up the stairs, and that was okay, but pushing a button in an elevator was not okay for her. And mm-hmm. so we need, you know, it's easy to laugh, but we need to understand these things in mm-hmm. order to understand Judaism aright and in order to understand the first century. If we don't, there's no faster way to get yourself confused about Scripture than to try to read it while ignoring its historical and cultural context. If you ignore the context, you're pretty much guaranteed to miss it.
All right. Well, with all these undesigned coincidences, and before we go to the next one, how about giving us some of your own tips about how we can learn to spot our own undesigned coincidences? What are some questions we should be asking ourselves of a text?
You know, here's the deal. When you're reading the Gospels,
mm-hmm.
ask natural questions.
Mm-hmm.
Ask questions like, how'd Matthew find out what Herod was saying to his servants? Or, mm-hmm. I wonder why they didn't. You know, when I make a doctor's appointment, I want to get in right away. And was human nature just different back then? No. So why would they wait? Ask those natural questions, and then put your hands on a good parallel column harmony of the Gospels and read it across the columns and see if you can find, in this case it would be in Mark's account of the story. See if you can find in some of the other gospel maybe a little extra bit of information. That'll help with some of them. But then in the case with the one with Herod and Luke's mentioning Joanna, the wife of Chuza, there you just have to be alert as you're reading across all of them. And it's important to remember we have no right to demand. This is not a demand for corroboration from a second source, right? We have no right to demand that all of our questions will be answered. Maybe your question won't be answered. But keep it in mind. Look for it. I have had friends who have found additional undesigned coincidences that neither I nor any source I had read had come up with. And so it can be fun. I'm not suggesting it as a substitute to reading for your own personal edification, but it can be fun to look for your own. And so I would say get a good Harmony of the Gospels. I like A.T. Robertson's Harmony of the Gospels for Students of the Life of Christ. It's got the benefit of being free. And if you like, I can give a link so that Deeper Waters listeners can get their own copy of it, download a copy of it online. So I can give you that link later if you like.
Yeah, I have to be after the show, definitely. And I think by what you said about answering questions, that's how I got into some of my insights that later on I thought, oh, this is exactly what N.T. Wright and such are talking about. And see, I was going through Matthew 4 one time, talking about how Jesus went all through the society preaching the gospel. And, you know, we're usually told the gospel is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, but Jesus wasn't going around preaching his death, burial, and resurrection. He was preaching something else. How does this tie in with the gospels? And I really consider, because of asking those simple questions, that one of the greatest, you know, light bulb moments I'd had interpreting scripture.
Yeah, no, I think that's a wonderful thing to do. So, by all means, ask normal questions. And then don't be afraid to go and look in good resources. There are plenty of brilliant scholars who have covered a lot of this territory. Don't be scared to go read a book just because it's fat. If you want, you can start just looking in it for the answer to your question, but you may just get hooked and find you're reading the whole book. And, you know, nothing could warm my heart more than the thought that maybe some unsuspecting listener will get roped into reading lots and lots and lots of large books. That would make me very, very happy.
Yeah, I can tell listeners that my own time when I found out about apologetics, before too long my parents started getting very, very scared, because every time I went to a bookstore I came home with more and more books, and it's like, where are we going to put all of these books? Like, even before I got married, since I was going to be sharing room with someone else, I had to I had to get rid of some books, which was very hard, but
inexpressibly painful.
Yeah.
You know the famous statement of Erasmus?
If I get money, I buy books, and wherever I have left over, I get food and clothes.
Right. I like that. He's a man after my own heart.
Indeed. In fact, when I was getting ready to get married, I was at the apologetics conference, and I knew I had to save up for a wedding, so I only bought two books that year, and my friends bought The Invasions of a Body Snatcher as I'd taken place. I definitely agree with Tim. Everyone, don't be afraid to read a big book. Of course, there's a lot of good things and a lot of small books written for a popular level. We're not going to deny that. There's a lot of great material out there in small books. But if you want the real scholarly, in-depth stuff, you have to read the big books. There's no exception to it. I was telling Bethany about, we've had Mike Lacona and Gary Habermas on here. They wrote together The Case for a Resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Right.
Great book. Fabulous book. I highly recommend it. But if you want the real scholarly, in-depth look, and I'm not denying their work is scholarly, of course, but if you want
the
real scholarly
greater detail,
stuff, you have to get Mike Lacona's book, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach.
Right, and also maybe N.T. Wright's Resurrection of the Son of God, which is a very brilliant piece of work.
Well, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about another concern with the Gospels, and we'll get Tim McGrew's thoughts on that. Call-in number is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
We are here with Tim McGrew. I'm Nick Peters, the host. Our guest is 714. Our number is 714-242-5180. And we're talking about the Gospels right now and their authenticity. If there's one aspect that certainly gets them called into question, it's miracles. Now,
oh, yeah.
Yep. Now, one other aspect of this question also is that we're often told, well, you know, the Gospels contain miracles, and you Christians accept those, but go show us Apollonius or something like that, and all of a sudden, it's not accepted. What do you do with Gospels and with miracles in other religions? Well, Tim, you have an answer for that, don't you?
You know, the funny thing is the question is so often asked as though Christians had never considered it. And that is, I'm just going to editorialize here a bit. That's something I find amusing and frustrating at the same time about so much discourse on this. So many of these questions have been handled so well before, and people are just unaware of what's been said. And because they're unaware of it, they go about reinventing both the objections and the replies. I would like to see the whole discussion move to a better level, and part of doing that is just being aware that, you know, that question has been asked and answered for a long time. Not only was the objection raised by David Hume in his Essay of Miracles back in 1748, and then immediately, and I think crushingly, answered by a bunch of his own contemporaries, but the question had been around earlier than that. And the reason, sort of a funny thing is, the reason is that there had been a lot of claimed miracles in the ecclesiastical history. You know, the Catholic Church had a bunch of claims. By the way, not all devout Catholics feel that they are bound to endorse all of those. But the Protestants had felt it necessary to come up with criteria for distinguishing an authentic miracle from something that wasn't or that might not be.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, of course, here, I'll just give you one thing from Charles Leslie, who's writing at the very end of the 17th century, very end of the 1600s. He said, look, if you want to know that something happened and you can bet your life on it, you want to be absolutely confident of this, here's what you can do. Look for four marks or four rules that your evidence meets or addresses or obeys. And if you can find something that has these four, then you can be sure that it happened. Here they are. It's got to be a matter that's public. It can't just be, you know, some one person says, oh, I saw this, but nobody else was around while the angel was talking to me. And it's not that an angel can't talk to somebody. It's that we're putting together a cumulative case of four kinds of evidence, which, if they're all met, mean you can bet on it. There may be many true things that don't meet these, but the things that do meet them, so Leslie argued, they are true. So the first one one of the four is that it's something that's public. Also, it's got to be a matter that's open to the senses. It's got to be something that men's outward senses, their eyes and their ears, can attest to. That's Leslie's language. It's got to be something such that some act or monument of commemoration was instituted at about the time the event transpired, and then either that monument has lasted or that commemorative action has been performed in an unbroken line from that time to this. And what Leslie says is, with the resurrection of Jesus, you've got it. Here, it's a matter that's not just one person saying, oh, I saw Jesus, right? What happened when the women came back to tell the disciples that they'd seen Jesus at the tomb. Luke tells us. They ignored them. They thought these sounded like idle tales. Ah, here's a bunch of giddy women saying nonsense. This is a serious matter. Go away, you crazy women. You know, a perfectly understandable Jewish male first century reaction where the testimony of women in court was looked down upon and where the women would not have been the kind of people you'd invent. N.T. Wright makes this point. Not the kind of people you'd invent to be the very first witnesses of the risen Lord if you wanted your story to sell well with a Jewish audience. So, yeah, of course, you know, there's the response to just one or even a small group there would have been no, but this is something that, you know, as Bethany said in her call, appealed to a wider audience. There was supposed to have been 500 people at once, the some of them dead by the time Paul was writing 1 Corinthians. Let's move on for a second criterion here. A matter open to the senses. A lot of people have tried to push the idea that Jesus' resurrection body was just a ghostly apparition of some kind. Now, here, I want to put in a plug for a book you were just endorsing, and this is Mike Lacona's book, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. One of the things I think Mike does brilliantly in that book is that he completely destroys the whole Soma Pneumaticon idea that a spiritual body has to be an intangible body. In fact, I think he shows decisively that that just won't fly. That can't be. So, it was tangible to men's senses, and, you know, this gets us back to the question of miracles in general. Oh, well, you know, you can say that, but then these people were so barbaric and crude, and they didn't have modern science. Okay. Could they tell the difference between a living man and a dead one?
Yeah.
Do you think?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are people who had probably a lot more up-close and personal contact with death than most of us do. Unless you work in a hospital morgue or an undertaker's office, you probably don't encounter dead bodies as frequently as a Palestinian peasant in the first century did. So, yeah, they knew the difference between life and death. That's all they needed to be able to bear witness to two crucial facts. We saw him dead, and subsequently, we saw him alive.
Yep.
So I think, you know, the whole misdirection, wow, these are unsophisticated people. You know, C.S. Lewis's friend, Austin Farrer, got so frustrated with that stupidity, that line of objection, that he actually put a question on the Oxford exams, the tripos. And the question was simply, just how ignorant was a first century Jew? Didn't know where babies came from? Didn't know the difference between a dead body and a living one? How ignorant? Go ahead. Fill us in and tell us why. You know, and I think that's a brilliant question to ask. So there's the two criteria fulfilled, and those two criteria, Leslie says, are to secure us against any imposition upon the original witnesses, to secure us against the idea, well, they were just confused, right? They were imposed upon in some way. The other two criteria. Well, what could be a monument commemorating the resurrection of Jesus? Here we've got something simple and beautiful. It's the transfer by devout Jews of the day of worship from the Sabbath day to Sunday, from the seventh day of the week to the first day of the week. We find this in the book of Acts multiple times. We find it in the Pauline epistles. When he's taking up a collection, he says, you know, on the first day of the week, set by what you've got, and then it'll all be there when I come. We've got it in the book of Revelation. It was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. It's called the Lord's Day.
Mm-hmm.
I think the evidence of the change of the day of worship is really a significant piece of evidence and deserves very careful consideration. There's no precedent for that. There is no precedent whatsoever. There's not even a precedent in Judaism for celebrating a day by calling it by the name of someone famous. Not Abraham. There is no Abraham's Day. Not Moses, the lawgiver. Not David. not Judas Maccabeus, the restorer of national dignity. There is nothing in Judaism which is so-and-so's day, David's day, Maccabeus' day. There are festivals regarding events. But in this case, it's called the Lord's Day.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's significant, and we could get into more details about that, but that is just one thing that satisfies Leslie's criterion that there be some act that commemorates the event. And, of course, we can look at church history. We see no period whatsoever in which the Christians were ever worshiping other than on that day of the week or ever failing altogether to do it. You get Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, Pliny the Younger, writing to the emperor saying, these Christians, they're kind of disrupting temple trade, and I tortured a couple of deaconesses, and here's all I could find out. They met on a certain day, a stated day, and they'd sing hymns to Christ or something, as to a god, and then they'd break up and they'd meet again later for a meal, and they say that's all there was to it. A stated day. What do you think? You know, he doesn't bother to tell us which day. No sound historian doubts that it was Sunday. So mm-hmm. This is something that we've got going back right into the New Testament documents. We've got it from outside pretty early. This is something that we have from the Church Fathers. You can find it in Justin Martyr. This commemoration requires an explanation. It's a datum that requires an explanation. What Leslie is trying to do is to draw our attention to that in the framework of an argument that's designed to show us why alternative explanations are not going to be highly credible. And then,
okay.
You know, that completes the four criteria. That's only one set. I haven't even talked about John Douglas. He's got more criteria. And Leslie's got another set of more criteria as well. But that'll get us done for starters. So when you look at a putative miracle, if you want to be sure that it happened, and ask yourself if it meets those four conditions. It may be it really happened, even if it doesn't. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real hard sell to say it didn't happen if it meets all four of those criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Does that
and
make sense?
Something else we can say on this for our listening is that in 3 weeks' time, on August 10th, we are going to be having Craig Keener on here to talk about his book, Miracles, which I'm sure you know has been pretty much ignored by skeptics everywhere and just disregarded right off, ipso facto.
Yep. Well, Craig's a genius of a very special order. You're very fortunate to have booked him for this, so please give him my greetings as well. He's just a dear friend of mine.
So are there any miracles outside of Christianity that you give credibility?
You know, Craig's got this entire book full of just documentation of reported things that sure do look an awful lot like miracles. I have not gone through the whole – it fills two fat volumes. You're talking about reading long books. Mm. This is one of those ones that I've got on my to-read list, but I haven't got through it. I've glanced at it. It's interesting. Right now, I am not going to say that I'm persuaded, but I've also, you know, Craig himself has just told me personally some stories for which I will be the first to admit I do not have a good naturalistic answer. And I'm usually a guy who looks around for one. I just mm-hmm. don't elevate that into a methodological principle that says you always have to, or any naturalistic answer is always better than any non-naturalistic answer. That's ridiculous. That's irrational, but I'm fine with looking around for a naturalistic answer for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But there can come a point when evidence is mounting up where you have to say, okay, well, you know, I don't have a better explanation, and it looks like maybe I should accept that this was in fact a supernatural event. So I want to be cautious, but not
why
close.
Why is it that you'd say that this idea that any explanation that's natural is better than the contrary?
Well, I think you can try to defend that position only by trying to offer a really cogent argument that miracles do not happen.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there is no really cogent argument that miracles do not happen. There are bad definitions of miracle that can, you know, like, a miracle is a violation of God's own will or something like that, which is more or less where you go with Spinoza. Well, you know, if God's omnipotent, then his own will is never violated. Okay, but, you know, who defines a miracle that way? Why would we accept that definition?
How about a miracle as a violation of a law of nature?
You know, that one's tricky. That's Hume's favorite definition. It's tricky because of the term violation. You have to be very careful talking about what that means. I can give an example here. Do we have time for me to maybe just take 5 minutes and give an example?
Sure. Just try and make it as brief as we can.
Yeah. So let's, you know, imagine a bird who lives in a tall tree in a forest far away from man. He's never seen a human being. And his tree is young and healthy and strong. And so he flies away on a clear day, spends a pleasant day eating grubs at the borders of a local marsh. When he flies back, he finds that the tree he's been living in is lying flat on the ground. It's been severed neatly at the base. Well, what's the poor bird supposed to believe? He knows that sometimes dead and decaying trees splinter and fall. He knows that sometimes in bad weather trees fall, but neither of those is the case here. And so what does he say? He doesn't know what to make of this. So he goes maybe to the next meeting of the Avian Skeptical Society, right? And he hears them giving all kinds of alternatives. Well, you went to the wrong tree, right? Maybe that was it. Or you hallucinated your trees being fallen down. Or you're just lying to us for some crazy reason. Or your tree never existed, right? Here's all these answers. Well, what's the real explanation? The real explanation is that something beyond the range of his experience, with causal powers beyond anything he's ever seen, has intervened in the situation, right? Mm-hmm. We know about chainsaws. He doesn't.
Yep.
And so a miracle is, if you want to call that a violation, it's a violation of the causal closure of the physical universe. It's a case where something happened not at random, not for no reason, but because a causal power that has not been working often hitherto has now interposed here within your realm of experience. That's why you're so startled. That's why it provokes wonder, which is the original root meaning of the Latin word from which we get miracle. It's a wonder, or it causes us to wonder. It's because something's intervening from the outside. If you want to call that a violation, as long as we're clear what we mean, I'll actually grant it. But the problem is, all of the evidence we've got regarding the uniformity of nature, and by the way, we all agree that nature's got a lot of uniformities, that's all when nature's left to itself. That does not tell us what happens when nature is not left to itself any more than it would have told the bird what happens when his tree is not left to just the ordinary course of the kinds of causes he's familiar with.
It's interesting how we go with different standards, because your main concern was on violation, and if I was asked, my main concern would be laws of nature.
There's a whole literature on that too, sure.
Yeah, because in my position you can look at, say, that it's like that. I also have a reason to think that these things outside cause laws of nature. I think things are acting according to the substances that they are. And so Hume's criteria can fall on both counts.
Right. That what you're looking at is a view according to which the sort of powers and liabilities of natural objects give rise to their behavior, and there is nothing above and beyond those powers and liabilities called the law that is in some sense doing something. And that's a respectable view. That's a view with lots of respectable adherence. I'm willing to not be too picky about it because I think it fails either way.
Yeah. But are there any miracles outside of Christianity that you think really do have some credibility?
Well, sure. I think the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea in the Exodus has credibility. And interestingly enough, Leslie brings that up as an example that meets his four criteria within Judaism. But you might say, well, you know, that's Judaism. How about let's go for the miracle of Joseph Smith translating Egyptian documents without ever having studied hieroglyphics, or the miracle of the Hindu milk miracle where the statues of Ganesh were lapping milk out of spoons that were being held under the trunks of these little idols. And we can talk about that, but I think you're coming up on a break here.
I am, but right now I'm kind of experiencing a little bit of technical difficulty, so let's go ahead and talk about the
I'll do the Ganesh one. This is funny. Some years ago, there was a sort of flash phenomenon where a bunch of Hindus said they were offering a little spoonful of milk as a sacrifice to their idol of the god Ganesh, and Ganesh was drinking the milk. Wow,
mm-hmm.
You know what? This little elephant head just curled its trunk down and sucked it up? Well, no, but the milk level did look like it was lower in the spoon afterwards. So you know, somebody mentioned this to my wife, and being the hard-headed empirical woman she is, she went into our kitchen, she took out a spoon, she used water instead of milk, and she took the underside of a little hot plate, a little trivet plate that you would use that's made of ceramic, and it was unglazed on the bottom.
Mm.
So she filled the spoon up with water, and then she touched it up against the unglazed pottery on the underside of that little tile, and then she lowered the spoon. And wouldn't you know, some of the moisture got sucked up into the unglazed tile. And if you think about the geometry of a spoon, and a spoon is explicitly what they said they were using for this Hindu milk miracle, it doesn't take very much coming off of it in terms of total volume to produce a noticeably smaller area in the spoon. Right? It goes down pretty fast because that spoon's really shallow. So just the sheer geometry of the spoon and the fact about unglazed pottery means, yep, you touch it up underneath that, it'll suck it up. And I just wonder when people fling these out, you know, well, the resurrection, just like the Hindu miracle. Really? You think? Or do you think that if you can do it in your kitchen, you know, how about you try the resurrection in your kitchen? Get back to me on that. Tell me how that worked. So, yeah, that just... I don't know. The idea that Christians have never thought about that it's going to come as some kind of devastating shock to them that other religions claim miracles. Well, you know, one of the things you could perfectly well say is, yeah, well, maybe those things did happen, right? There might be multiple explanations of those. There might be demonic influences at work, etc. So you don't even have to say, oh, that couldn't ever have happened. You could approach it with sort of the friendly skepticism that I would advocate anybody approach any miracle claim with. I'm willing to be persuaded, but right now, it's not seeming like it to me. Tell me what you got. And if the evidence turns out to be really, really good, maybe you should be persuaded. And if it turns out to be not really, really good, then maybe you shouldn't.
Okay, well, we are going to take that break now. Looks like we got the difficulties taken care of, and we'll be back with Tim McGrew after this. My call number is 714-242-5180.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. TruthRadioNet.com.
I can't believe in you today. Oh, I can't close my eyes and make it go.
I'm Nick Peters. Our guest is Tim McGrew. Call number is 714-242-5180. And, you know, I'd like to spend some time talking about one of the most common names in atheism today, and that's Richard Carrier. And I know you've got a real problem with a mythicist position.
I do. So let's just explain for listeners who might not know what this is. There are all kinds of ways to be a non-Christian. You
mm-hmm.
can think, you know, Jesus existed. He was a good man. I think we might know something about what he taught. I don't think he was God. You can take that position. You can mm-hmm. take the position, Jesus was really a cynic sage, or Jesus was really somebody who was, you know, an itinerant Jewish preacher who thought that he was going to bring about the immediate establishment of a theocracy with himself at it, you know, in on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
You can say all these things, but pretty much the wildest view to have anyone at all, and there are very few, you know, you can almost count these guys on the fingers of one hand, but this view, the pretty much the wildest view that anyone out there holds that I've run across, is the idea that actually Jesus never existed, just did not exist. That's the position held by Richard Carrier. Richard's got a PhD in Roman history, although I think it's focused in Roman history of science. Haven't read any of his books on the history of science. If he's got them, that just hasn't come across my desk yet. But he's best known for having sort of increasingly outspokenly advocated the position that Jesus never existed. To get there, you've really got to go down the rabbit hole, as they say in Alice in Wonderland. When you're that far down the rabbit hole, you start using really curious methodology. One of the favorite methodological moves of Carrier and of a lot of uncredentialed guys on the internet who don't have even the credential that Carrier's got, is to make arguments from silence. Well, if Jesus existed, how come Philo of Alexandria doesn't talk about him? Which sounds good when you think, yeah, their lives overlapped quite a lot. Philo was a Jew. Okay. But why should he talk a lot about him? What positive reason is there that we should think Philo would? Philo, for all that we can tell, went to Jerusalem once. We really don't have any definitive word on any other travels to Jerusalem. He lived in Alexandria, hundreds of miles away. That's why he was called Philo of Alexandria. So there's really no particular reason to think he should have. Why doesn't Josephus mention Jesus? Well, he does, actually, and it's only in the fever swamps of internet mythicism that the view really flourishes that the Testimonium Flavianum in Josephus' Antiquities, Chapter 18, is a wholesale forgery. Looks like it mentions Jesus. Yeah, some Christian hand probably interpolated a couple of things in there, but it looks like it does mention Jesus there and did in the original. You know, but here we've got Gospels, we've got letters, all of which mention Jesus, all of which give us a window on that time in the generation immediately following Jesus' death. Why should we not take this as excellent evidence? Well, you know, the argument from silence usually gets a boost from a little bit of well poisoning. And so here's how we poison the well. We say, well, yeah, but, you know, the New Testament stuff, that was written by Christians. All right, so what's the problem? Well, I mean, of course the Christians believed in Jesus, right? That was part of their propaganda. But propaganda, you know, that's a kind of tendentious way to describe this. If we're talking about people who sincerely believe in something, are you going to wipe out all testimony to the existence of, say, Plutarch from people who believe he existed because they're Plutarchians?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just ridiculous. Well, all right, let's try to make it a little bit better than that. These people were committed to the belief that Jesus not only existed, but was a very good and important man at the very least. Yeah, that sounds like people who believe in the existence of Abraham Lincoln, many of whom, though some of my friends down south might beg to differ with part of this, many of whom would say he existed and he was a very good man, right? Okay, so, you know, are we going to ignore testimony from those people? You've got testimony from the people most intimately concerned. For the rest of the Roman Empire, Christianity was a fringe segment of Judaism, which was itself a kind of fringy, weird religion for wackos on the far eastern rim of the empire. The Jews were a despised people, and if the Jews despised some subgroup of themselves, why should Seneca care about it?
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was...
That, we can also... Oh, go ahead.
When I was listening, getting such that I listened to Richard Carrier on, I think, Bo Bennett's show, the Debate God podcast, and he's being interviewed on his book, Proving History, at least the first part of it. And he's been working using Bayesian theory in this area. Now, Tim, you're somewhat of an authority on this, aren't you?
I've been known to write a bit on it, yeah.
Okay.
I want to say something up front. I have seen some of Carrier's reasoning. I have not read that particular book. So I can say things about the reasoning I've seen, but I can't give you, you know, an authoritative reaction to that book because I haven't read it yet. Frankly, it's just not real high on my list of things to read.
But you've seen some of his work on Bayesian work, right?
I have. I was underwhelmed. I think at least as recently as a couple of years ago, he had some pretty severe misunderstandings of what this kind of probabilistic reasoning is like and how it works. I suspect and I hope that he's talked with some friends who have been able to give him better counsel, and so perhaps he doesn't make quite as many outright errors mathematically and conceptually as he was doing a couple of years ago. But I do know that one of the problems with using a formal system is that it gives you this wonderful feeling of power. But it's kind of like computer programming. You put garbage in, you get garbage out. And so the question then becomes, are the assumptions he's feeding into it proper? So take the assumption that if these various events had really happened, we would hear about them in some other source or sources that still exist. Is that a reasonable assumption? What would happen if we applied that assumption to cases in secular history? We already talked about the case of the eruption of Vesuvius, but we can talk about other cases. Alexander the Great. One of the histories of Alexander the Great says he slaughtered an entire town he came across, the Brancati. Did he actually slaughter them? Oh, well, we have other biographies that don't say so. Shall we then just throw away the one source that says he did? Well, that would not be good. Herodotus says that Xerxes, during the wars, got so frustrated with losing ships trying to round a certain point that he ordered that a canal be cut clean across a little rocky isthmus that stuck out there, the Athos. Now, this is more than a mile wide. It's very rocky. The idea that he loaded ships across Mount Athos is ridiculed by Juvenal in his satires. Ships sailing across the Athos, another bold lies of the Greek poets. But in point of fact, Herodotus is right, and using modern techniques, we've located that canal. It's all silted up and grown over, and you can't see it with the naked eye, but you can use satellite imagery and other imaging techniques. You can locate it. He did, in fact, cut it. Herodotus was not lying. Uncorroborated, and yet quite right. If we use the argument from silence, we'd end up going wrong. And that happens over and over and over. I could give you a dozen examples of cases from ancient history through quite recent times where if you use the argument from silence, you will get it spectacularly wrong. And there's nowhere other than biblical studies where the argument is used so freely and is so widely considered to be decisive.
Well, I'd like to share with you a couple of things. These aren't direct quotes, but kind of paraphrases, where he said that when he was being interviewed about this, the guy who interviewed him said, "I didn't get to finish your book because you listed some sources online and such for understanding Bayes' theorem, and I got started doing those sources," and Carrier responded and said, "Well, you shouldn't have done that. You should have just gone through the rest of the book," which is fine. He said, "Because I think my material on Bayes' theorem is better than those sources."
You know, let me read the book, and then I'll interact with the comment. I don't want to say something about something I haven't read directly. A couple of years ago, that would have been a risible, ridiculous statement. Demonstrably, Richard was very confused. And at that time, he was already publishing papers with this in it and giving lectures with this in it and making egregious errors, not understanding the binomial theorem, misinterpreting just what it means to say that something is a negation of something else, just really bad mistakes. Maybe he's got it all cleaned up and he's now a leading authority and you need nobody else. I confess I am a bit of a skeptical person. I think skepticism is good. We just don't have to reserve it solely for the Gospels.
Mm-hmm. Well, a theory I've got with this kind of thing is that it's easy for a lot of mythicists to start taking this route now because they anticipate, and I think it's quite correct, that most people out there in the realms of historical study really don't understand this kind of thinking. So all they do is look and say, this looks impressive. It's got to be right.
And it does. It can look impressive, you know, whenever you spread a bunch of equations out on a page, that looks good. And it might be good, or it might be completely bogus. The proof is in the reasoning behind them. So that just like formal logic or mathematics, the Bayesian probability is a tool. If you use the tool skillfully, and that requires some skills beyond just mathematical manipulation, then you can get really wonderful, deeply thought-provoking and insightful kinds of results. If you use it carelessly or sloppily or with bad data, you can get total nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and I'm afraid in the case of mythicism, that's what, you know, I'll eventually get around to looking at the book, but the mythicism stuff is just desperately, desperately misguided. Really, I think, truly hopeless.
Why is it, though, that it seems so popular, especially when you go on the internet? It seems the most common position held by atheists today online is Jesus never even existed, and it's chanted with as much force as any fundamentalist says Jesus rose from the dead.
You know, here's the thing. The internet has some very curious properties. There's a reason why we seek of many of the things on the internet as social media, and you need to understand them as you need to understand, in fact, what goes on in some churches as a social phenomenon. In this case, there's a kind of self-selection and reinforcing that goes on in some of these communities where they hear themselves talking just like a very insular, closed group of Christians might hear only themselves talking. And it becomes very easy to believe that they're in possession of the truth. Everyone else either doesn't understand or is just dumb. And or is maybe wicked, right? You know, they're evilly suppressing the obviousness of what I'm trying to say. You know, there are pig-headed people out there, but in an echo chamber kind of environment, it's easy for a view that has no real intellectual credibility to seem very impressive, and people get very possessive about that. Carrier, in fact, had a recent run-in with Bart Ehrman. Now, I've got a lot of problems with Bart, but this was over whether Jesus existed, because Bart just came out with a book saying, whether you like it or not, he existed. He might not have done all the same things that the Christians think, but yeah, he existed. And Richard got a bit hot under the collar and published, I dare say, some rather intemperate remarks. And it's been a source of amusement to watch him writing and see some of Bart's replies and see some of the way other scholars are coming in on this. Richard is nothing if not self-assured. So I don't see his being open to changing his mind on this subject anytime soon, but it makes very funny reading.
Yes, I even remember watching the video of his debate with my father-in-law, Mike Lacona, and him say, you know, if God wanted to get his message out, why didn't he do something like tell me what it is? About it.
Well, and, I mean, obviously that would have been it. Why not just tell Richard, leave everybody for 2,000 years to wait until Richard came along? You know, there are lots of ways of being unreasonable. One of them is complaining about the evidence you don't have instead of engaging with the evidence you do. If the evidence you've got is enough, then there's no sense complaining that you want more. If the evidence you don't have, you know, would have been better, maybe that's true, but that doesn't change the answer to the question, is what you've got enough? If what you've got is not enough, say that. That'll be enough, but show it. Don't just bluster. But to talk about the evidence you don't have is just misdirection. God's primary purpose was not to ensure that Richard Carrier would be psychologically incapable of disbelieving in the atonement. That was not God's primary purpose. We may be assured that if it were, it would have taken place. God might have wanted Richard to get better methodology and made it available to him.
Okay. Well, we're going to take one more break. And there's one final topic I'm going to talk with Tim about, and I don't think it's even one he mentioned with me, but I think it's important to discuss. And we'll be back after this break to discuss it.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind all you listeners that, yes, we are supported by people like you. We need your support, so please consider making a donation. You can make a donation to me through my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, but there are other ways. You can go to risenjesus.com and let them know that this donation is for me here at Deeper Waters and my Ratio Christi site at Issues and Answers. Now, we got Tim McGrew here, but call number is 714-242-5180. And Tim is someone I've really considered a very good friend as well. I mean, this guy's done so much to help me out personally. And there's one piece of advice he usually gives, and it's I'd like to really share and have him expound it, because in the apologetics world, we're told we need to read the best and the latest studies, and I seriously doubt Tim would disagree with that. But Tim also says we have to read old books. Tell us a bit about that.
Amen! Thing. Yeah, I'm a big advocate of reading old books. You know, one thing I'll say right off the bat is we have forgotten some truly brilliant works. And those works deserve to be recovered sheerly for the merits of the people who wrote them. Sometimes they were responding to their own contemporaries. Take Hume's essay of miracles. Several of his contemporaries, Adams, Campbell, Douglas, Leland, responded and responded very well in great detail to everything that he said. And frankly, I think that there has not been anything in the 20th century that has been written that has done such a sustained job of criticizing Hume so thoroughly and so effectively as some of those original critics. These were men who took their work very seriously. The Anglican minister was one of the wonders of the world at that time. These were guys who knew many languages and were familiar with a vast literature. They took their work very seriously. Have we learned some things since that time? Absolutely. Are there things that you're going to learn from reading a book by Mike Lacona or N.T. Wright or Craig Keener or Craig Evans that are going to go beyond what you can learn from a book from the 18th or the 19th century? Sure there are, but there's also an awful lot that's really good that we've forgotten. If you want to know about the authorship of the fourth gospel, you could learn a tremendous amount from reading works by Brooke Foss Westcott or by Bishop J.B. Lightfoot. They have done just beautiful, brilliant work that should never be forgotten. And so, yeah, I think that's really important. Another thing is, when you read the older works, you discover really quickly that the new questions are mostly not new. The new questions are actually rather old. I was talking with a friend of mine, another member of the Christian Apologetics Alliance, about the claim, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. A lot of people, if they've heard that, think that it's Carl Sagan's original question. I pulled a book from the 19th century off the shelf, handed it to my friend. I said, look at this chapter. It has an entire chapter that begins with the question, is it true, and if so, in what sense, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? Well, I mean, you know, if the questions are not new, and yet they're raised over and over again as though nothing's ever been written on them before, and as though this, finally, this is the decisive thing. This should bury Christianity. You know, Richard Dawkins writes a book and he says, my objective, if I've done my job right, people who are Christians when they pick this book up will be atheists when they put it down. Well, that's amusing, partly because it shows his really vast historical ignorance. He has not even a clue that he's reinventing the wheel and not even doing it as well as some of those who came before him, and they were answered and answered well in their own time. So I think that reading these old books is wonderfully useful. Also, something C.S. Lewis said about reading old books comes into play here, and that is older authors, like contemporary authors, have their blind spots. They have things that they just don't see clearly. But their blind spots usually are different from our blind spots. And what that means is that they're usually pretty clear on the things that we're getting wrong and taking for granted. So one of the best ways to secure yourself against the danger of falling in for your own blind spots is to read the works of people from another time. If we could get into the future, reading the books of the future would do the job too. Unfortunately, we can't get them. So we should read the books of the past.
I think you've even said before to me that Bart Ehrman has some of the best objections of the 19th century.
Yeah, Bart really loves to recycle material that, you know, take the Western non-interpolation hypothesis of Hort. You know, he's pulling that out, or the early 20th century, the Walter Bauer thesis about the history of Christianity and the development of orthodoxy. Bart is recycling an awful lot that went round in the 19th century. That doesn't make it bad by itself. Don't misunderstand me. I advocate reading old works sometimes for their arguments. What it does mean is that when it was absolutely decisively answered centuries ago, it's inexcusable. And to trot it out as though it had never been noticed before and is now just the latest new thing, you know, every publisher wants to say late scholarship, recent scholarship. I love what my friend Bob Stewart said, introducing me once as I was speaking down there in New Orleans. Bob said, Tim's discovered arguments that are so old, they're new. And I thought, yeah, that's just about right. That's just about exactly right. They're so old, they're new.
Another example of that is this copycat idea that Jesus Christ was a copy of pagan religions at the time, which was really popular at the start of the 20th century or so and has now kind of died out. But on the internet, dead arguments receive our new life.
You know, the internet, I think, sometimes really does deserve to be described as the place where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. It's like a sink for all kinds of craziness. And the problem is anybody can set up his own little echo chamber, right? And then the two dozen or so people who are unhinged enough to get really excited about the idea that Jesus is a copy of some pagan, you know, the Horus or Osiris, you know, one of these Egyptian things, they can all get together. They can start a website or three, start blogging on each other's websites, and suddenly it looks like, oh, yeah, you know, we got a movie out there and everything, and this is a serious position. And it's also incredibly naive. It really almost makes one weep. But there is, you know, there are a lot of beautiful things about the internet. This is one of the kind of silly sides of it, is that you're going to get people who are into things like that, and they're just going to keep talking to one another. It, you know, I'm not going to shut them down by force. Let them gabble, but we should definitely be more than happy to meet that with cool reason and public facts, which in that case, wow. I mean, I can't even begin to find words adequate for describing the multidimensional lunacy, which is the Horus kind of theory. That's just wow.
Yeah, I've told people several times on here that I have my own blog that this show is named after. In fact,
yeah.
I want to caution people that I'm not downing blogs, okay? There are a lot of informed people that have blogs. I would think I'm one of them, but there are a lot of people who don't and who have blogs. So just because you read it on the blog on the internet, don't take it as gospel. And heck, that goes for my blog, because I'm sure I've made mistakes in what I've said and that I'm going to make mistakes in the future. So when you read something here, consider it as something that, you know, you might give some general reliability if you know me, if you know my work and you think it's generally reliable, but please check up on things you read online. Go to your university or library or whatever and look these things up.
Wait, Nick, are you trying to tell your listeners that it's possible that someone on the internet is wrong?
yeah. Sad enough, it happens. Yeah, someone on the internet
wow.
is wrong.
Who knew?
You know, there is something with old books that has come as a blessing in the age of the internet, since we can transfer information electronically. A number of these books can be found for free.
Yes, absolutely. I've pulled a few of those together on a little page called the Library of Historical Apologetics, historicalapologetics.org.
Mm-hmm.
Just hit the Browse the Library tab, and you will find links where you can download. I've got a couple dozen, I think, up there that you can download. Those are selected. They're some of the best of the best. And have a ball. I've got a little bibliographic description mm-hmm. for each item. And if you browse around there, you will find new friends. Sometimes our
mm-hmm.
best companions are the dead. And in this case, you can definitely find new friends. I know people who have told me, you know, I finally found the pastor I always wished I could have had online. And these are people who go to church and they love their church and they're involved in their church, so don't get me wrong. But, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. you just find that mind that your mind calls out to and it calls back to you. And you say, yes, I separated from this person by 150 years, but I'm a kindred spirit. And so if you'd like to go to the Library of Historical Apologetics, historicalapologetics.org, that's just mm-hmm. one place to start your search. And I hope to be able to make a much wider range of resources available, waiting on some developing things here, which I'll be able to tell you all about in a few months.
You know, one such older writer, although he did live in the start of the 20th century some, that I'm thinking about right now is G.K. Chesterton. And
sure, absolutely.
So disregarded, and yet he was one of the primal influences on C.S. Lewis, and his work is so engaging. When I lived in Charlotte, I lived with a roommate before I got married, and I let him borrow my copy of the Father Brown Mysteries, and he figured he'd start reading it around midnight, one night, and just go through one mystery. I don't think he got to bed till around 2 or 3 or so in the morning, because he had to read 3 mysteries before he could finally stop.
Yeah, no, I love the Father Brown stories. I love Orthodoxy. I think that's just a brilliant work. I think The Everlasting Man
mm-hmm.
is a wonderful piece of work, very imaginative. I don't always agree with everything Chesterton says,
yeah.
but I always think he's an interesting writer, and when he is right, he has mm-hmm. a way of being toweringly right,
mm-hmm.
brilliantly, overwhelmingly right, in such a way that you just mm-hmm. say, everybody should just see this. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I love reading Chesterton. Great example. But just one example where we could name many, 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 many more. Go to the Library of Historical Apologetics. Find a double handful for yourself and sit down for some good reading. And while you're at it, pick up the latest book by Craig Keener or Craig Evans and keep yourself abreast
yep.
of what's going on in more recent stuff. Craig Blomberg on New
mm-hmm.
Testament studies, Doug Grotheis. There are just some wonderful people out there who are doing excellent contemporary work. I'm not in any way trying to say this is a replacement for the modern stuff, but the modern stuff's not a replacement for the older stuff either. Read them both.
Yeah. And speaking of Craig Blomberg, we did have him on our show also back in June 1st, and he's got another book coming out later on about stewardship and finances with Christianity. He's going to be back here again to talk about it. With these old books, since we're talking about the finances a little bit, You can go to a library of historical apologetics, but another route you can consider, with some of them, not all of them, you can go look on Amazon in the Kindle store. It is incredible how many of these books are free. And apologists that are just on a budget and say, hey, I want something to read, you can download these and read to your heart's content. In fact, when Tim's been here and he's mentioned some of these offers, I've looked up on my Kindle right here and started seeing, can I find this book for free?
Yeah, and so all the stuff that we've got's free. You've got free stuff in these other places. There's also, let's see, isn't there a collection of Christian classics of apologetics online? I'm not the address. I think it's maybe Classic Apologetics.
Yep. In fact, it's my ministry partner that runs it. I'm checking on it right now to see what the address is.
I think it's
Classic Apologetics.
ClassicApologetics.com. Right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I'm saying it on top of you. That's another great place to go. They've got an awful lot of stuff there. Much more stuff than I've got, but their stuff's also more diverse, covers a wider range of topics. A lot of stuff on the American Founders there as well. But definitely another place that you want to go, that you want to look, if you're looking for some of these great old books. So check them both out.
Okay. Well, Tim, we've only got about 4 minutes left in the show, so just a few things at the end is just how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about this stuff?
Hey, I teach at Western Michigan University. My address is a matter of public record. If you want to write me email, I cannot promise I can respond to everything, but I usually do try to respond to most polite inquirers. I occasionally get the other kind. No promises. If you try that route, you may get what you deserve. But if you've got a sincere question or you're interested in finding a resource, I'd be very happy to talk to you. Join the Christian Apologetics Alliance if you're a Christian with a strong interest in apologetics. I try to stay active there and answer questions and contribute to some of the discussions there. So that's another good way that you can get in touch with me. Drop over to Nick's blog. I can say it too, Nick. You've got a good blog, and he's got some really interesting material there. Poke around, ask some questions. That's, I occasionally have come over there and commented as well. So that's a place. That's a good place to hang out. But I would say, if you really want to get in touch with the apologetics community, the Christian Apologetics Alliance on Facebook, and to some extent also now on Google+, is really a good place to go. I would advise that if that describes you, Christian, sound, traditional faith, strong interest in apologetics, come on in and play nice, but ask your questions, and we will try to give answers.
Okay, and we've got about 2 minutes and 40 seconds left, so what final message would you like to leave for our listeners?
If you really care about giving answers, then right now, in America, you're in the minority among Christians. And what that means is two things. It means, hopefully, if you're suited for the work, your work is really needed. And it also means you're probably not going to get a lot of fame or money or glory for doing it. So if you feel the calling to this area, you say, this is really something I need to be doing at whatever level. It doesn't have to be a professional level. It could just be something that you're doing on the side, doing in your church, doing with some friends or some college students that you know. But get involved and don't expect that it's going to be appreciated. Don't expect that you'll get a lot of praise for it. Do it because it's the right thing to do. Do it because you love it. Do it as your reasonable service to God. And it's very fulfilling if you approach it with that mindset and on those terms. Unfortunately, these days, the apologist is, in most cases, not very widely appreciated. And in some cases, it's just distrusted. But strive to make that distrust unwarranted, to be the kind of person who could be trusted to lead a church service and lead people well, to talk with people and answer them well. And you will have a reward that may not come from men, but it'll come from somewhere better.
Yeah, Tim, I certainly appreciate you coming in on short notice as well. In fact, it's been an awesome time. I wish we could have talked so much more, but, you know, I hope we'll be seeing you back here again sometime in the future.
You know, maybe we can do it again. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great.
It's been a great privilege and a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
Well, next week my guest is Jeff Harshberger of Refuge Ministries, hopefully. There's a chance he might not make it, but hopefully. And we'll be talking about the occult that day. So I hope you'll tune in next week. For now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off with Deeper Waters.